Good morning. பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் ஸ்ரீ அன்னை தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதாரவிந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் துவங்க இருக்கிறது. அன்பர்கள் அனைவரையும் இதில் பங்கு கொண்டு அன்னையின் அருளை பெறுமாறு தாழ்மையுடன் வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறோம். Now I am inviting Mr. Gary Tekkas. Please.
Good morning. Today is the 24th anniversary of the Rani Pet Meditation Center. I'm very happy that we can have a Life Divine meeting on that day. Have you ever been in a situation that seemed really hopeless? Have you ever felt cornered? Have you ever felt like there's no solution, there's no possible way to achieve what we want to achieve or to remove the obstacles that we face? If so, this chapter, chapter 18 of Life Divine, offers a knowledge to you that can conquer over any obstacles. In earlier chapters, Sri Aurobindo has told us how Satchidananda created the universe, how existence, consciousness, and delight of being through the power of supermind have manifested the universe. Together, these four principles represent what he calls the upper hemisphere of existence. In the last chapter, chapter 17, Divine Soul, he describes how the divine soul would experience the world with the perfect knowledge and delight in the truth consciousness, knowing that it is one with all other souls and that it is one with the divine being. It's one thing to say that the divine soul can experience a blissful supermental existence, but that's not enough. Sri Aurobindo says the goal of the manifestation is a divine life on earth, here, for us, in a physical body. In that case, we have to try to understand how this world that we live in was made. The lower hemisphere, mind, life, and matter. In this chapter, he tells us that mind, life, and matter are themselves created by supermind and are in their origin divine. Then he explains how mind was created, why it was created, its purpose, and how it has lapsed into the ignorance which we enjoy today. I think the best way to understand mind is to contrast our mental way of seeing reality with the knowledge of supermind. So I'd like to take the example of the way human mind envisions reality at a time when we are beset by problems, crises, or a sense of helplessness. Let's start with the situation that Elizabeth Bennet is in at Lambden Inn after she visited Pemberley. 2 days earlier, she went on a tour of Pemberley, fell in love with the beauty of the place, dreamed of becoming the mistress of Pemberley, met Darcy by surprise, who greeted her very graciously, and she felt on top of the world. She could look back on all that past encounters and laugh about her quarrels with Darcy and her infatuation with Wickham, because everything seemed to be forgotten. She could dream of a future full of prosperity, happiness, and adventure. Surely now Jane would marry Bingley. Her father's financial difficulties would be over. Her father could visit anytime he wanted. The Gardiners were accepted by Darcy as cordial guests. Georgiana would be her new younger sister. All the family problems would be over. And Elizabeth woke the next morning at Lambton Inn, looking forward to life as a heaven on earth. In 2 hours, everything changed. This morning, in a small room at Lambton Inn, she received two letters from Jane announcing that Lydia has eloped, and her whole world collapses. All her dreams disappear in an instant. They don't exist anymore. They vanish. Beautiful Pemberley is merely a distant fantasy. The future seems full of darkness without hope. There's no friend who can help her. She's all alone in her despair. She finds herself living in a nightmare. How could that reality change so quickly, so dramatically? Was that dream all an illusion, a Maya? Is this really the reality of her life? Is this what she has to accept as her future destiny? What happened to all those glorious possibilities? Were they simply an illusion? What is the truth? And what is the real reality? Well, the truth of the situation is really very different than the way Elizabeth understands it at that moment, looking at it through the ignorance of her mind. The real truth, if you want to know it, is that a 19-year-old woman named Jane Austen had an inspiration to write a story of high romance and joyous fulfillment. Elizabeth doesn't know anything about this. She's never heard of Jane Austen. Jane Austen conceives of a story for the sheer joy and delight of creative self-expression. Her story expresses a real idea, the idea of romantic love, and a cheerful individual rising through love. In Jane Austen's creative imagination, she envisions two strangers meeting, one full of pride, the other full of prejudice. They come from different social classes. They meet, they rub each other on the wrong side, they insult one another, dislike one another, quarrel with each other. Then they discover the truth, gradually, that they're meant for one another. Elizabeth's abuse makes Darcy realize he was selfish and arrogant. It helps him discover his soul and transform himself into a good man. Darcy's letter to Elizabeth at Hunsford makes her realize her false infatuation with Wickham and give up that low consciousness she inherited from her mother. She feels ashamed. She rises from the vital to mental consciousness. She evolves. The reality is that Darcy and Elizabeth are souls longing for union. The reality is that they're destined to fall in love, marry, and live happily ever after. The reality is that all of this is a creation of Jane Austen's creative imagination. She wrote this story 200 years ago. It's already lived for 200 years, and even today it's one of the most popular novels, maybe one, almost the most popular novel ever written. And surely it will live for many more centuries as a fairy tale of inspiration to men and women aspiring for high accomplishments and love. Now these two pictures are very different, starkly different. Elizabeth lives in a nightmare, Jane Austen lives in a fairy tale. Which is true? Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. Elizabeth thinks her nightmare is real. We know it's only a story. And not only a story, but it's a story that's going to have a happy ending. But can we convince Elizabeth that this is the case? Let's try to explain to her how she actually got into her present predicament. Let's try to explain to her how Jane Austen created this story and the character of Elizabeth Bennet. Let's give her the knowledge that will make her realize the truth of her situation, why these things are happening to her, the truth of her destiny, her future as Mistress of Pemberley, the truth of her being, of her soul, which is that she's really Jane Austen. Sri Aurobindo says that it's possible for Elizabeth to know the truth of her being even as she's experiencing it. And if she knows that, if she discovers that, she can convert the nightmare into paradise in a moment. That is the knowledge and vision that the supermental being has. This is the knowledge that Sri Aurobindo offers us in Life Divine, so that we can awaken from our problems, from our worries, our fears, our crises and nightmares, our sense of limitation, and convert them into unlimited opportunities to make our lives heaven on earth. With this knowledge, we can express the delight of existence even in the most challenging situations. We can laugh at adversity and know for certainty that the intensity of the moment comes to reveal and release in us spiritual truth, power, and delight of becoming. He calls this knowledge the process of creation. In chapter 18, he summarizes all the stages and steps by which the divine has created the universe and reveals the crucial error by which we have lapsed into the world of ignorance and falsehood that we live in and know so well. Understanding this knowledge gives us the power to reverse the process and transform human life into life divine. So let's start by reviewing the process, the main steps of the process. Let's use the analogy of Jane Austen creating Pride and Prejudice as a means to understand our own situation. We start the process with Jane Austen as a person who feels the delight of becoming and being. She's a person. She's not just an author the way we know her. She's a writer, she's a daughter, she's a sister, she's a friend, she's an English woman, and many other things. But all of them are only aspects of herself. Each of her characters in her stories is a projection of one of her infinite possibilities. She can create an infinite number of characters because the potentialities of her personality are infinite. She's capable of writing any number and variety of stories, as Shakespeare wrote comedies, histories, tragedies, and love poems. She's not limited by the stories she writes or the characters she portrays. She's beyond and greater than all that she manifests. She's capable of creating a whole universe or many universes. But she's never limited by what she creates. She takes delight in all that she creates. She represents the transcendental divine being, Satchitananda. She is the symbol of the transcendent self that lives forever in infinite bliss. But that's not all she is. She's also the author of a story, many stories. We're interested in her, particularly her aspect as the author of Pride and Prejudice, in her personality as an author who creates stories, characters, and events. How does she do it? She does it by a process of self-conception. She creates stories and characters by the power of her creative imagination. First, she conceived of the story in her imagination of a man and woman who fall in love and marry. She imagines the story in space and time. It occurs at the time of the French Revolution, 200 years ago. It takes place in a small town of Meryton, about 50 miles from London. She imagines different characters, Elizabeth, Jane, Lydia, Mr. and Mrs. Bennet, Mary, Kitty, the Gardners, Carolyn, Bingley, Darcy, Wickham, Lady Catherine, Collins. All these characters are projections, emanations of her own creative imagination. They're all aspects of her infinite being. And she projects her consciousness into each of these characters. Like the playwright, she describes how each of these characters should appear and behave, what they would think and look like, what Elizabeth would look like, how she would wear her hair, how she would dress, how pretty is Jane, how handsome is Wickham, how they will behave. How does Elizabeth smile when she hears Darcy call her tolerable? How does she cry when she reads the letter about Lydia's elopement? What do her characters think? How foolish and irritating is Mrs. Bennet? How proud is Collins? What do they feel? What does Lizzie feel when she reads Darcy's letter at Hunsford? Jane Austen, as the author, envisions a set of circumstances. The French Revolution is raging across the English Channel. There's a prosperous family in Longbourn. A rich man comes to Netherfield. Beautiful Pemberley is like heaven on earth. She envisions a set of events, an evolution of consciousness in the story from ignorance to knowledge, from suffering to delight, from hate to love. Pride meets prejudice. Both of them are blind to the opportunity. He insults her, she hates it. He prevents Bingley from marrying Elizabeth from Jane. They part. They meet again at Rosings. They quarrel and abuse one another. They each experience a revelation about themselves. Again they part. They meet again at Pemberley. They both want to marry. Suddenly, tragedy comes to interfere with everything. Lydia elopes. The fairy tale becomes a nightmare. It does so to raise the intensity of their love to an even greater height. So Elizabeth can understand, discover how fortunate she is. So Darcy can shed all his reservations about her family and prove how much he loves her. Darcy saves the day. Lydia and Jane marry. Lady Catherine comes as the last obstacle. And finally Darcy returns and proposes. All this takes place in Jane Austen's creative imagination as the author. And as the author, she symbolizes what Sri Aurobindo calls the comprehending supermind, the first stage where Satchidananda manifests itself through a process of self-conception. She conceives the story. Comprehending supermind conceives the world, the universe, and everything that's in it. All that Jane Austen, as the author, imagines and creates is contained in herself. There's nothing outside herself. All is herself. So, too, the universe we live in is contained in the divine consciousness. We think of the divine consciousness as out there somewhere. It's in here, it's out there, it's all around us. We live in it, we breathe it, because there is nothing else. nothing else exists. Her story is a manifestation, a becoming of her being as the author. The universe is a becoming of the divine. Jane Austen's power of creative imagination is similar to the power of Supermind to create a world and everything in it. Supermind creates by the power of self-conception. Jane Austen's consciousness pervades her entire creation, so also the divine consciousness pervades and upholds everything in the real world. All is divine. All is Brahma. She conceives of the story of Pride and Prejudice with a character named Elizabeth, destined to rise to great heights through marriage. Supermind, which she represents, is the self-extension of the transcendent, Satchitananda, which universalizes itself to become the world it conceives. As comprehending Supermind, Jane Austen, the author, contains, habits, pervades all the forms it conceives and permeates them. All these forms are forms of her consciousness. The world of Pride and Prejudice is one universalization of the consciousness of Jane Austen, one of the many potential universes she can create, one of her many stories. Jane Austen as the self becomes the universe of the story and all existences within it. Yet she's never limited by anything she becomes. All that she creates are truths of her divine being. The universe is an objectification of her creative consciousness. The story of Pride and Prejudice represents a real idea to her. One of her infinite qualities and potentials which she projects forth into creation. Aurobindo says that real ideas are willed intentions of the divine. They are truths of being that guide the manifestation in space and time, just as Jane Austen's ideas guide the course of the story. The real story, the real idea is the story of an individual rising through marriage to great heights of momentum on the momentum of social evolution in England. All the characters are one with her being and of one consciousness with each other. They don't exist separately. They exist in her. They share the same essential consciousness, the consciousness of Jane Austen. As the author, she sees the story in its totality and in all its separate elements, but they're all from one comprehensive perspective. Not from the perspective that Elizabeth sees the story now that she's at London Inn, where all is dark and gloomy and impossible. Jane Austen sees it from the overview, the way we see it now, because we know the whole story. It already exists for us. For Jane Austen, there's no separation or division in space and time. All the characters, events, and actions exist simultaneously in our mind, just as they exist for us now. All the places coexist in her mind. All the points of time coexist simultaneously. She can see the beginning, the middle, and the end of the story with one view, as we also can. We already know the ending. We know there's nothing to worry about. Jane Austen is never lost in the moment, blind to the past and future, the way we are, the way Elizabeth is at this moment at Lambton Inn, because she has the consciousness of Supermind. Supermind creates the world in time and space just like Jane Austen creates her stories in her creative imagination. The infinity of the one translates itself into an extension in conceptual space and time. That's what he says. And what the supermind creates is real, fully real. It is the world we live in. We too are its creations. as James Austin's characters are forms and expressions of her creative consciousness, we are formed from the consciousness of spirit. Jane Austen is not just the author of this story, but we can also take the analogy further and say that she becomes the director of the play or the movie that we have all seen. The story conceived by the author has to be manifested in space and time. That's the role of the apprehending supermind. The author imagines herself as the director of a play or a movie in which the entire story is acted out. So now let's see what Jane Austen does as the director making her movie. Many authors have done that. The director guides this work of objectifying the story in space and time. She has to manifest, by the power of her artistic imagination, so many living characters and events. As the director, she has to select the actors for each part, the setting, the costumes, the sequence of acts. She has to imagine herself as each of the characters in the story. She does this by a process of self-multiplication. Now, the idea of characters in the author's mind, she has to actually multiply as characters in her story. She projects the force of her consciousness and multiplies herself to create many forms of herself. The director has to imagine all the different characters that he needs to create, that he needs to execute his story and give life to each of them. Jane Austen, as director, has to imagine the scene, the circumstances, and the events. She represents the apprehending supermind. The apprehending supermind translates infinite possibilities into a specific arrangement of forces, forms, and movements. The director is the universal divine who views the universe she has created and populates it with all the elements that she needs. She becomes the forms as the self becomes all the forms in the universe. Like the poet, the divine views the creation of his own consciousness placed before him. He sees his own work of art as an object to his own perception. He is the player. He's the playground. He's the play. He becomes the players. He becomes the playground. He becomes the play. In apprehending supermind, the self-conceptions of the divine, held within the comprehensive consciousness, acquire an objective reality as differentiated forms and objects. The one becomes a multiplicity of souls, of forms. But all of these forms are forms of the divine being. Now let's go one step further. The director needs actors to play his parts. The individual characters have form, but they need life. So the director needs somebody to take the role of each of those forms, each of those characters. He has to select actors to play the roles. The actor represents the soul of each character that gives it life. Let's assume for a minute that Jane Austen is also the actor, and that she's capable of playing multiple parts in the story, playing multiple parts the way Kapalahasan. It's there somewhere. The way Kamalahasan played different parts in Dasavatara, or Shivaji, I think he played 10 parts. Shivaji played 9 parts in Navaratna. So Jane Austen as the director is going to also become an actor and play each of the parts in her own story. How does she do that? She has to assume the part of each actor. She has to climb into the shoes, as we say, of each of the characters and look out from within side and think how the character would think, feel how the character would feel. She identifies herself with each of the characters that she's defined and plays the role of the characters in her own story. She imagines herself as Elizabeth, receiving Collins, proposing at proposal at Longbourn, abusing Darcy at Hunsford, defending herself against Lady Catherine, reading Jane's letter at Lambton Inn. Even when she's acting the part of Elizabeth, she can still remember that she's also Jane Austen, the person. Jane Austen, the author, Jane Austen, the director, who's greater than all these things. Just because she's acting the part, she doesn't forget who she is as a human being and all the other things she is. As an actor, she represents the individual divine in apprehending Supermind. The universal divine has projected itself into each of the forms it has created, and it looks out from inside each of those forms, from inside each of us. And inside each of us is the same individual divine. Just like Jane Austen playing the part of all the characters in the story is the same Jane Austen acting different parts in the story, all the time aware of who she is. So the individual divine is that part of the divine that enters into each of the forms and lives within it, inhabits it, the inner inhabitant of all creation. The universal divine is that which is all around, projecting these forms. And the individual divine is within them. And just as Jane Austen can be the actor, the director, the author, and the person all at the same time. The individual divine and the universal divine are the same divine. They're not two. They're not many. It's one, taking multiple viewpoints. So Jane Austen, the actress, represents the apprehending supermind, the individual divine. But she doesn't stop there. We've not yet finished the process. As an actress, she plays multiple parts. But she can also become the character. And that is, she can't be acting all the parts the same way. It's not enough that she gets into the dressing gowns of Jane and Elizabeth and Mrs. Gardner and Mrs. Bennet and Lydia. She has to behave differently. She has to think differently and feel differently in each of those parts. She has to identify so much with each of those characters that we feel the character has come to life. The character is unique and different than all of the other parts she plays. Only then it will be real to the audience. But of course, no matter how many characters she plays, she never forgets that she's an actor playing the part, that she's the director, that she's the author, that she's the person. But she keeps that knowledge in the background. And when she plays the character, it's kind of like our soul. Our soul is a projection from the individual divine, but each of us is a different projection. It's the same individual divine, the same divine behind us, projecting out a different capacity, a different set of characteristics, different vibrations of truth, different divine possibilities in each of the roles it plays. So the individual divine is really the actor in our lives, acting through all of us, but acting so well that each of us seems to be different, unique. Each of us expresses a different perspective, a different attributes, different values, different attitudes, different characteristics. Jane Austen, as the actor playing the character of Elizabeth Bennet, represents the spiritual individual. No longer the same in everyone, but different in everyone. This is the real source of our individuality. The individual divine playing a different role in each of us. The soul identifying with one aspect of its infinite possibilities that distinguish it from all the other souls. It takes a unique standpoint, like Mr. Bennet does when he insists on repaying Mr. Gardner for the wedding expenses, which surely most people would not have done. Like Darcy, who goes off to London in search of Wickham. So the spiritual individual has a different standpoint in each of the forms, the same way the actor takes on different aspects of personality to give life to them. Here he says, the individual, the spiritual individual, acts differently than all the other forms. It relates so that it can relate to each form uniquely. So Elizabeth relates differently to Jane than she does to Lydia or to Mrs. Bennet or to Mary or to Kitty or to Mrs. Gardner or Georgiana or Darcy. So we get the possibility of these characters acting differently with one another and experiencing the world differently. But all the time, they still know each of them is being a part played by Jane Austen, the actress, the one actor, following the instructions of the director, according to the script of the author, expressing a creative possibility of Jane Austen, a person. So there's no ignorance here. As spiritual individuals, we still know that we are a part of the divine, that we are expressing a truth of the divine. We are not separate from one another. We are not separate from the divine. We are a part, an expression, and a manifestation of the divine. But we haven't gotten to Elizabeth Bennet yet, the Elizabeth Bennet who's sitting in Lambton Inn while we're talking, feeling the world has come to an end. Jane Austen has to go one step further in order to really represent the Elizabeth Bennet as we know her, or to represent us as we know ourselves. She has to forget that she's Jane Austen. She has to forget that she's a person writing a story, directing a play, acting a part, playing a character. She comes to believe that this character is really real. Not only that it's really real, but it's all she is, and she's separate from everyone else. She lives in the ignorance. She lives in avidya, the ignorance, because she has forgotten who she really is, as we have forgotten who we really are. Jane Austen, the actor, playing the part of Elizabeth Bennet, identifies so closely with Elizabeth that she becomes her. She finds herself anxiously waiting for Darcy to propose. She feels horrified when Lydia elopes. She feels hopeless when Darcy leaves the inn. We don't feel that way. Jane Austen, the author, doesn't feel that way. Jane Austen, the director, doesn't feel hopeless. Jane Austen, the actor, doesn't feel hopeless. Jane Austen, when she forgets who she is and thinks she's Elizabeth Bennet, she feels hopeless. She so entirely identified herself with the character that she forgets she's acting a part, following the instructions of the director, according to the story that she herself has written. She actually believes she is Elizabeth Bennet. Something like this is actually happened in real life to the actors who filmed the BBC version of Pride and Prejudice. During the filming, Jennifer Ely, who played Elizabeth Bennet, and Colin Worth, who played Darcy, fell in love with one another. They actually perhaps thought they really were Elizabeth and Darcy. Not entirely, of course. They know their names are not that. But they believed themselves to be so much like those characters that they fell in love with each other in real life for some time. As Elizabeth Bennet, Austen actually believes she's at Landen Inn. She's in love with Darcy. Her sister Lydia has eloped. Wickham will never be prevailed on to marry Lydia. Lydia is lost forever. Her family's disgraced. The situation's hopeless. All her prospects are destroyed. Darcy will never come back. She's heartbroken. Why? Because she's fallen into ignorance. Avidya. Avidya is the soul that's become separated, living in the separate ego, thinking itself separate from everything else, feeling itself, sensing itself as if it's independent and separate from everything else. Avidya is created when the divine mind becomes the creature mind, the human mind. The true Elizabeth has forgotten. The truth she's forgotten is that she's the author. She's the director. She's the actor. Similarly, we have forgotten. We are the divine being who has conceived, created, and become the universe, who has become our soul and the conscious spiritual individual. And we think we are caught at this moment, in this place, in this body, and that's all we are. We are Brahman now, living as characters in our own story, but ignorant of the truth of our being and our own destiny. We don't know the ending. We don't know the happy ending. That's why he calls avidya the self-ignoring faculty, because it ignores the truth which it knows deep inside, which our soul knows deep inside. Like Elizabeth, we feel separate and alone among people who are really parts of our own being. We compete with them, we're jealous of them, we're angry at them, sometimes we hate them, but they're all parts of our own being. And finally, let's not forget the audience. Who is the audience that's enjoying this story? That too is Jane Austen. Jane Austen, as the audience, takes delight not only in the happy ending when Darcy comes back and proposes. She enjoys, as I think we all do, the quarrel between Darcy and Elizabeth when he proposes at Hunsford. She enjoys the conflict and the battle between Lady Catherine and Elizabeth when Lady Catherine comes to Longbourn. She enjoys the whining of Mrs. Bennet and the falsehood of Wickham. She enjoys and takes delight in everything. Because all the time, she knows it's her creation for the joy of creation. She is really the playground, the player, and the playing. Now, how great is the difference between this perspective of Jane Austen as the author, as the playwright, and Elizabeth Bennet as the character. Just at the point, think of the difference. Just at the point when Elizabeth thinks the world is ended, Jane Austen feels the story has reached its perfect, exciting climax. This is their greatest moment in creative literature. The characters feel the peak of intensity. Love has seeking a great intensity. Jane Austen feels the whole fulfillment of the future coming at this moment by building up the intensity. At the same time, Elizabeth Bennet feels it's the end of the world. What's the difference between these two ways of experiencing the same event? How come we, like Elizabeth, are blind and ignorant and think we're living in a nightmare or a hopeless case when the divine being knows that this is a moment for exquisite delight? It's a moment of greatest opportunity for us to come out of the ignorance into the knowledge. How did we get into this mess? How do we escape from it? How do we understand how we became ignorant so that we can discover the way to get out of it? That's really what he wants to tell us in this chapter. Jane Austen lived in vidya, in the knowledge. Jane Austen, as the author, as the transcendent divine, she knows the whole truth. She lives in the consciousness of the divine soul. But Elizabeth lives in the ignorance because she lives in mind. So what is mind? Why is it created? Why does the divine create a mind? He says that mind is essential for manifesting the universe. It's the mind that enables the infinite to appear to us as finite form. Life is infinite. Everything is infinite because it's the infinite that is manifesting. The story of our life is infinite. But if I ask you, what would you say if I asked you to tell me the story of your life? Your life has consisted of an infinite succession of moments. Which moments would you select for your narrative? If you're 40 years old, you've already lived more than 14,000 days, more than 350,000 hours, 21 million minutes, and about 1.2 billion seconds. Which of these are you going to tell me about to tell me about your life? You can't tell me about all of them. Supposing you choose just one out of those 14,000 days to speak about, which one are you going to choose? What aspect are you going to describe? Even if you do that, you'll only account for about 86,000 seconds out of the 1.2 billion that you've lived. But you can't do all of that. So let's simplify it. Supposing you want to tell me about one moment in your life, one moment on one day in your life, can you really fully do it? Let's take a single moment in the life of Elizabeth in the story, the moment in which Darcy calls her tolerable. Can you describe it? Well, in a single sentence, we can say Bingley suggests to Darcy that he dance with Elizabeth Bennet. Darcy refuses because no one else is dancing with her, and she's only tolerable in appearance. And she overhears it. Finished. We've described the event. Or have we? Or is this just the tip of an iceberg? This simple event is a microcosm that contains the universe. The whole story is there, compressed in it. If we really want to explain what happened at that moment, we have to mention the fact there's a French Revolution going on across the English Channel that made the English aristocracy nervous. Otherwise, why would Bingley and Darcy even be at a dance with all these common people? Why should they be mixing with these rural folk? We have to mention that Bingley's the son of a wealthy merchant trying to come up in the world socially, by keeping company with Darcy, who comes from a landed, wealthy landed old family. we have to mention their character. That Bingley's a submissive person and Darcy's dominated, opinionated. That Bingley's lighthearted and flighty. We have to mention their feelings at the moment. Bingley has just danced with the most beautiful girl at the ball, Jane Bennet, and he feels a sense of triumph. And maybe he never gets to triumph over Darcy on anything, because Darcy's older, wealthier, more important, and more educated. So he comes over being proud of the fact that he's danced with the prettiest girl, and he asserts himself. Unusual for Bingley, he says, "Don't be stupid, Darcy. Go and dance with somebody." How does Darcy feel when this Bingley, who we always look down on, calls him stupid? He's probably angry. And as a result of that, Bingley's going to have to wait a full year in order to marry Jane, because Darcy, consciously or probably unconsciously, is going to teach him a lesson. Don't call me stupid. I'm going to stop this whole romance in its tracks. We have to also know who else is present there, if we want to understand this moment. Lydia is running around making a fool of herself, but enjoying it. Mrs. Bennet is talking loudly and crudely, to the embarrassment of her family. Carolyn is eyeing everybody with disdain. And there are so many other people we have to talk about. We'd have to mention the atmosphere of the dancing hall, the lighting, the furniture, the temperature inside and outside, how crowded it is, what the people are dressed, how they're wearing, how good the music is, what are they playing, how happy, excited, quiet, peaceful, cheerful, energetic the characters are. And still, we'd only be scratching the tip of an iceberg to talk about this one moment, 30 seconds of our lives, because each moment is infinite. So you see, even a single moment in the story contains an infinity of detail. Papa summed it up this way when he called Elizabeth tolerable within hearing. Subconsciously, he was making his first proposal to her. So we have to go into the psychological depths, not only of what they did or what they thought, but what was there in the subconscious. Because life is infinite, Papa has already written 3,000 pages of commentary on a 350-page story, and he plans to write a full of at least 10,000 pages. Why, he's written probably more than 100 or 200 pages just on the time she's reading Jane's letter at Landon Inn, because there's an infinity behind each event, because it is the infinite presenting to us in each event. So what enables us to see this infinite and handle it? It's mind. Mind is the power that converts the infinite into a finite appearance. We don't see the infinite. When I tell you that Bingley went up to Darcy, told him to dance, Darcy called her tolerable, she heard about it and laughed and went away, you're satisfied. You heard the story. You know everything. Actually, you know only an appearance of everything. It's mind that makes us think we know when really we've only seen a facade. It's mind that tells Elizabeth that Wickham's a good man because he's handsome and charming. She doesn't know he's a rogue, he's a scoundrel, he's a liar. Because it takes the infinity of his personality and presents it as something simple and finite to appearance. It's mind that tells her that Darcy is arrogant and mean and doesn't enable her to see that he's also good and honorable and true. It's mind that tells her at the moment when Darcy leaves her at Landon Inn, well, I'll never see him again. She's sure, it's over. It's hopeless. Now that he knows about the elopement, I'll never see him again. She's wrong, but she believes it because she believes the finite appearance that mind presents there. She has no conception that he's going to go to London, find Wickham, negotiate, spend a fortune, 6,000 or 10,000 pounds, to get Darcy and to get Wickham and Lydia to marry. She has no idea of that possibility because she lives in the ignorance of mind. So mind is a power of self-selective knowledge. It filters out a little and it thinks it presents that as the whole. Mind is the office that translates infinity in terms of the finite. Sri Aurobindo tells us that the infinity is like an ocean, and the finite are like the waves on the surface of the ocean. Mind sees the waves, it doesn't see the ocean. The waves each look separate. Elizabeth thinks. Elizabeth thinks that she's separate. She doesn't realize that she's a part of Jane Austen's consciousness, just like the waves on the ocean seem to be separate from. The ocean of which, from which they come. The waves have no independent existence. She has no independent existence. We have no independent existence. Ignorance results from our failure to be conscious of the infinite behind our finite appearances, the infinite from which we come. I'm aware of myself, not the infinite ocean of family, community, society, humanity, and universe of which I'm a part. When I think a thought, I'm not aware that my ideas, opinions, beliefs, aspirations, values, character, manners, behavior, all come to me from the society, from the family, from humanity. Because I think I'm a separate person, because I relate to the world through my mind, and I don't see the infinity of which I'm a part. He says that mind is a subordinate power of supermind for the purpose of delimiting, for the purpose of separating into multiple forms. Mind is the capacity of supermind to take the perspective of each of the forms it creates. So mind enables the divine to get inside of 7 billion human beings and look out from each one separately, as if it were a separate person. Actually, there's only one mind, as there's only one supermind, as there's only one divine. But mind in the ignorance, climbing into each of us, really thinks it's separate from all the others, is not aware of itself. In supermind, we would know that our mind is part of a universal mind, a divine mind. In the ignorance, we think that we're all by ourselves. It's kind of like saying that my cell phone exists all by itself. If my cell phone is not part of a network, if my computer is not tied to a network, it doesn't work, certainly on the internet. Our minds are part of a universal network, just like our computer and our cell phones, and that's what enables them to work. Mind divides reality, but the truth is, nothing is limited. Nothing is what it appears to be. It's the ego that limits, that gives us the sense of limit, not life. There is no such thing as an impossible situation. There is no such thing as a hopeless case. There is no such thing as there's nowhere to go from here, there's no way to accomplish what I want, except what our mind tells us. A few days ago, we were with a devotee, and he said, it's 2:30, and at 3 o'clock, there'll be power cut. I requested, please don't say that. Better yet, don't think that. Why should you give credence to power cut just because there's a 3 o'clock power cut every day? That day there was no power cut. It's mind that creates the power cut. by accepting limitations. When we don't accept the limitations of mind, we need not have power. The reality is infinite. Mind divides it into space, divides it into distance. It measures in time. You look at the earth. Where are the boundaries? Where are the borders between countries? There are none. There's no line between India and Pakistan and China or Nepal or Tibet or any other countries, all the European countries. There's no division. It's mind in our imagination that creates that division. Tamil Nadu, India, where are the states? The states are in our mind. India is one. Tamil Nadu, where are the districts? The districts are in our mind. Tamil Nadu is one. The divisions are an invention of our mind, divisions in space. So too, the divisions in time. That's India, of course. Time is like a river. It flows on and on and on. There's no past, present, and future in this river. The river is just always going on. But mind divides the river into past, present, and future. What it does is it situates itself at one point on the river. And it says, whatever is here is in the present. It exists. Whatever is past, gone past me is in the past. It doesn't exist anymore. And what's going to come in the future doesn't exist yet. But what the mind really means is I don't see it yet because it hasn't come past me. This is the function of mind, to divide and measure out, to separate things, to make them think, see, and as if they're separate, to de-piece, to cut up reality into parts. The way the director has to take the story of Pride and Prejudice and imagine it as different parts of the story, different scenes, different situations. Mind cannot see the whole. It sees only the parts. When it sees a material object, it describes it, it sees the form, it sees the shape, it sees the color, or the design. When we see material things, we don't see the molecules, atoms, electrons, and subatomic particles is made of. We see it as if it's a solid thing. Mind not only sees things as if they're as parts, it also fixes things which are really not stable, things that are constantly in motion. Because the whole universe is in constant motion. But nothing is really fixed. But mind makes us look at it as if it were fixed. The physicist tells us that matter is not something stable and fixed and motionless. But if you really know what's going on in the matter, it's atoms moving around at tremendous speed, subatomic particles constantly in motion. Nothing is standing still. Nothing in the world is motionless, but mind makes it look that way. My very body is constantly growing, constantly changing. I think I've got the same body I had for the last 65 years, but actually, the cells on my skin are only about 2 weeks old, same for you. My red blood cells are only about 4 months old. My bone cells, I'm really working on about my sixth set of bones. Every 10 years or so, the bones are completely replaced. But I tell myself I've got the same body that I started with. That's what mind does. Same thing with personality. Darcy says once his good opinion is lost, it's lost forever, meaning nobody can change. Darcy himself changes dramatically during the story. Elizabeth undergoes a transformation. In fact, we are never the same. When we see a friend, each time we see them, we recognize the same face, so we take it as the same person. But when the friend sees us, we know, yesterday when I saw my friend, I was happy, today I'm sad, tomorrow I'm expectant, then I'm disappointed, then I'm bored. Each time I'm different, my thoughts are different, my feelings are different, my outlook is different, my consciousness is different. One day I was anxious, now I'm peaceful and happy. We are constantly changing. But mind makes us think that everything the same. So mind gives the sense of stability. That's why the divine created the faculty of mind, so we can deal with things as if they're fixed, when actually everything is constantly moving. This mind is a power of supermind. He calls it a subordinate power of supermind. That's essential for the manifestation of forms. It's the function of mind to hold forms apart as if they were separate from one another so they can interact in space and time. Of course, nothing is separate from anything else. This mind is called the divine mind. It's the mind created by supermind. Our mind is the creature mind, the human mind, in the ignorance. The difference is, whatever our mind knows is partial, incomplete, distorted. We don't have the knowledge of the divine mind. We have the ignorance of the creature mind. You can see it in the story. You cannot find a single character in the story that really knows what's going on. They're all ignorant. When Elizabeth sees Darcy at Meryton, she sees he's rich, proud, arrogant, and unpleasant. She cannot see he's got a good character, he's generous and honest. When he stares at her dancing, she has no idea that he's in love with her. When he comes to her at Hunsford, she has no idea he intends to propose. When he takes leave of her at Blamden, she's sure she'll never see him again. She's totally ignorant, and there's not one character in the story that's less ignorant than she is. Our minds are like that. More to the point, we are like that. We are ignorant all the time. Our consciousness knows only one aspect of reality with which we're identified, and that's the source of our error. We always think from our point of view. We always think from what we see in the moment, where we are in the moment. Our will is ignorant. Our consciousness is ignorant. This ignorance, he calls, the self-forgetting, self-ignoring faculty. How do we become ignorant? How does the divine mind become the creature mind, the ignorant mind? He says it happens by an exclusive concentration of the soul on one form of itself. That's us. I'm exclusively focused on being myself here at this moment, talking to you. I've limited myself. I've gotten so absorbed in thinking that I'm myself that I forget all else that I am. The same way Jane Austen playing Elizabeth Bennet at Lambden Inn forgets all else that she really is. It's this exclusive concentration that makes each of us feel separate from everyone else. When Mrs. Bennet schemes with Collins to marry Elizabeth, she never thinks of Elizabeth's point of view. When Darcy proposes to Elizabeth at Hunsford, he never stops to think whether she wants to marry him. When Lydia elopes, she never thinks of the consequences for her sisters. When Elizabeth reads Jane's letter, she feels totally alone, never thinks that Darcy's the part of her life and that he'll save her. That exclusive concentration makes us feel separate, and that sense of separation is the cause of all our problems, all our ignorance. Avidya, the ignorance, is like the actor throwing away the script and living and acting according to his own inspiration, forgetful of what the author intended or what's the plot of the story. We have thrown away the script. We forgot there's a script. And we think we have to invent things as we go along. If we really want the truth, we have to find out what the script is. We have to stop thinking for ourselves and doing what we want to do, acting for our own selfish interest, egoistically, thinking that we know what we're doing. We have to go in and find the script. We have to ask the actor to please read the script for the role I'm supposed to play. Having lost the script, having really believed that she is Elizabeth Bennet, she's self-absorbed in the ignorance. And that's where we meet her at Lambden Inn. Now, how is she going to get out of that ignorance? How is she going to liberate herself? How is she going to reverse this process? How is she going to rediscover the truth that she's really an actor, a director, a playwright, and a person, Jane Austen, that all the other characters are parts of herself, that the whole world is really her, and that she's created it for the delight of her existence? How is she going to get out of that? First of all, she has to stop identifying with her body and thinking this is all of her, that this being with in Lambden Inn as Elizabeth is all of her. She has to stop thinking that she's only got one life, that she's only one person, Elizabeth Bennet, when in fact she's an infinite number of people. She has to become conscious of the truth, recover the truth of things. How is she going to do that? Obviously her mind is going to have to fall silent, because her mind is an instrument of ignorance that's causing all this problem. She's got to stop thinking, stop willing, stop trying to understand, stop trying to take initiative, stop reacting and getting angry at everyone, because that's the source of her problem. We have to know ourselves in others and others in ourselves as part of ourselves. And goodwill and self-giving helps us relate to ourselves and others. We have to lose the separate sense of our individuality and think of things from other people's point of view. What would you tell Elizabeth if she comes to you as a devotee and asks for help? What could we tell her to help her understand her predicament and come out of it? Of course, she won't believe a word we say. If you tell her the whole truth, that we know that she's really Jane Austen, the person and an author, and this is only a story, she won't believe a word of it. So we're going to have to be a little more modest in what we tell her. If we tell her that her nightmare can convert itself into heaven on earth, it'll be hard for her to believe that that's the truth. Because that's what's going to happen. In fact, it did happen to her. She must have done something to help and make that happen in the story. What did she do? Let's trace back and look at the steps that she took to convert the nightmare into heaven on earth. After Lydia elopes, Elizabeth feels humility. She feels ashamed and humiliated by the disgrace that of her family. She realizes she's responsible for that. What happens? After some time, news comes that Lydia is getting married, something she believed was totally impossible just a few days before. Her humility changed her life. Her willingness to be humble changed her life, and it brought news of Lydia's marriage. Okay, Lydia is getting married, but still, Darcy is lost to her forever. She knows that. But she reflects. She accepts responsibility. She realizes this whole trouble came to her because she refused to speak out the truth about Wickham, because she was attracted to Wickham, because she's attracted to the falsehood in Wickham. When she realizes that and accepts that, she becomes truthful. What happens? When she becomes truthful, Lydia comes and reveals the fact that Darcy was at her wedding. Unbelievable, unimaginable. For Elizabeth, who was living a nightmare just a few days before, now Lydia's married, and now she finds out it's Darcy who was at the marriage. How can she understand this? It's a standing miracle. It's unbelievable. She quickly writes to Mrs. Gardner. She meets Wickham at Longbourn. When she meets him, she really sees that he's a shameless, shallow character, that he never loved her, that he's not worthy of love. She acquires knowledge. When she acquires self-knowledge, what happens? Mrs. Gardner writes and reveals that it's Darcy who arranged the marriage. It's Darcy who paid for Wickham and Lydia to marry. He's become a hero. Why would Darcy do that? Obviously, Mrs. Gardner feels that Darcy only did it because he loves Elizabeth. So what happens? Her hope awakens. Her aspiration arises. Maybe all is not lost. I thought all is lost a few days ago. Maybe it's not lost. Maybe there's hope for me. Let my aspiration come out. My faith come out. News comes that Bingley and Darcy have returned to Netherfield. When she understands that Bingley has come back, she knows he couldn't have come back without Darcy's approval. She feels grateful. Now she hopes that Jane can finally get married to Bingley. She loves Jane so much. She has such goodwill for Jane. Her goodwill comes to the surface. When her goodwill for Jane comes to the surface, Bingley comes and proposes to Jane. She knows this was not possible if Darcy has not orchestrated the whole thing. She's filled with gratitude to Darcy for his goodness and generosity. Lady Catherine comes to attack her. The final opponent comes. She battles with Lady Catherine because she's courageous. She's honest. And she, when Lady Catherine abuses her, her strength comes out. Her will comes out. I do want to marry Darcy. I will not refuse. I may have refused him in the past. I may have abused him. I will not deny, I will not reject him now. If he asks me, I will decide. But of course, she's already decided. Her strength comes out. Darcy comes back and proposes. This is actually what happened in the story. This is not metaphysics. Look back, think back to any time in the past where you felt trapped, where you felt hopeless, and you saw things reversed. It would have been through a process like this. What about now? Where are the limits in your life? Where do you feel, well, I would love to do this, but I know it's not possible. I have this problem. I know I can't solve it. I have a great need. I know I can't meet it. Recognize that that limitation is the limitation of the ignorant. Acquire the knowledge that's given in this chapter. Acquire the knowledge of the process of creation. Come out of avidya. Go to vidya. Know the truth. You are the determinant. You are the creator. You are the author of your life. You have that power. And Mother and Sri Aurobindo and Amma have given us the means to do it. All the tools and methods that we could possibly need in order to do it. You know them all. Appa's writing about them in all his books. If you want to become humble, if you want to recognize that other people are yourself, the first thing we should do is listen to what they say. Don't say, I don't care about what anybody says. I'm not interested in anybody else. It's like saying, I'm not interested in myself. Everybody else is yourself. Don't be so lost in our own opinions. Try to take other people's viewpoint, other people's standpoint. Get out of the ego and appreciate there's always another person's point of view. Be humble. Forget this sense of I'm superior to other people. Other people are also yourself. Recognize we're all ignorant, foolish, idiotic. And that if there's anything good in the world, it's what's come to us from the divine. And in the divine, we're all equal. Stop reacting. Reaction comes from the ego. No reaction is ever justified. And no reaction has ever helped anybody do anything. It's only a weakness. It's only a source of problems. Stop asking and demanding from others. If you have to will for anything, will silently. Better yet, offer goodwill to others, for them, for their fulfillment, the way Elizabeth did. Practice self-giving. Stop taking initiative, because initiative is for the ego. Stop expressing the ego so that something deeper in you can express, so that you can become a channel and an instrument for mother, rather than for egoistic fulfillment. Feel grateful for all you have received, for all of the knowledge and blessings and grace and every good circumstance that's there in your life. Remember mother, call mother, offer to mother. And if the problem persists in spite of all these things, which no problem could ever do, he says, forget the problem. Better yet, forget yourself. And beyond all of these, Mother has one other method. She calls it the Sun of Laughter. And I'm going to end with a brief passage from Agenda 1963. Nothing in the world can be done away with. Nothing should be done away with. But each thing must find its own place in total harmony with the rest. Then nothing would stop us from knowing, understanding, feeling, and living this wonderful laughter of the Supreme, who takes infinite delight in watching himself live infinitely. Nothing is wrong, but everything's out of place. This delight, this wonderful laughter which dissolves all shadows, all pain, all suffering. Find the inner sun and let yourselves be bathed in it. Then everything is but a cascade of harmonious, luminous, sun-filled laughter, which leaves no room for shadow and pain. Even the greatest difficulty, even the greatest grief, even the greatest physical pain, if you can look at them from there, take that stand there, you see the unreality of the difficulty, the unreality of the grief, the unreality of the pain. All becomes a joyful and luminous vibration. It is ultimately the most powerful means of dissolving difficulties, overcoming grief, and getting rid of pain. This luminous laughter which dissolves all shadows and difficulties, all discord, all disharmony, all that grates, cries, and weeps. This sun of divine laughter is the core of everything. It is the truth of everything. What is needed is to learn to see it, feel it, live it. We have a few minutes before 12. If there are any questions before we go on to kind of take a seat, would anyone like to ask a question? Ashok.
Yes, Gary, you, in the course of your talk, you mentioned about some devotee expecting power failure and you told him not to expect, and it didn't happen that way. You see, when situation is gloomy, people do have the gloomy forebodings. I don't see anything wrong with that. You take the monsoon season now, the newspapers are full of news about monsoon having failed, and they are raising talk of declaring drought in this and that state and all that. Newspaper is full of talk about emergency measures to avoid the drought-like condition. In such a circumstance, people reading newspapers are bound to get their fears of failure of the monsoon even more aggravated. So how to detach yourself from what is the news coming outside? And as you say, kind of activate the inner sun.
Very good question, Ashok. The question is, do we want to be part of the problem or part of the solution? When we understand this chapter, we know that we have the power to end the drought. We have the power to end the power cut. And as you know, the same devotee who stopped the power cut at 3 o'clock by not accepting it has also eliminated power cut in Tamil Nadu for 2 days a week and 4 hours a day for his factory by a change. The point is, yes, we can be part of the problem. We can be like everybody else living in avidya, in the creature mind, and then drought will continue and we'll feel hopeless. We'll never awaken from the nightmare. The whole purpose is to acquire the knowledge we have that power. We have to reject what the newspaper says and know that what the newspaper says is avidya. What's the idea of reading that? We can decide that there will be no power cut, that there will be monsoon. The devotees can decide it. Instead of waiting for it, instead of letting the meteorological people tell us whether we're going to have rain or not, if the devotees decide there must be rain, there will be rain, and Mother will bring the rain, and have that faith and that aspiration, and withdraw all that consent for drought. Oh, we finally have a drought year. We've had good years of rain. Now we have drought. If we can withdraw our belief in that, the monsoon can come tomorrow. The drought can end tomorrow. If you say that that's not easy, of course, it wasn't easy for Elizabeth to come out of the nightmare. It's the ignorance we're in. But that's the knowledge he offers us, these methods. Don't do it for ourselves. Do it for the country. Do it out of goodwill for all the farmers. Do it for the prosperity of the country. You're posing only the difficulty. The solution is what he gives in the chapter. We have to acquire the knowledge. I've tried to indicate the methods for that. Even if we can take this son of laughter and laugh with full joy at the situation, it'll vanish tomorrow. Mother in Savitri, Savitri laughs at the divine, at the death that way, and he disappeared. This is only a drought. Certainly, drought is no match for Mother's power. I see another hand from Sri Ranjani.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sir, in your presentation, you were talking about how when our soul has an exclusive concentration on into oneself, we feel this brings a separation from one another. And you
exactly.
had also given an example where an actor should first know the script. So he has to follow the script to enact the role. So I have a small question here. Say an actor knows the script of what is exactly being expected as an actor. He brings in his own individuality here and enacts it. In the story, we see that Elizabeth is not mercenary. She seeks a true romance and brings in her individuality. How to understand, like, how my mind feels that I should follow the methods, whatever you suggested, that, you know, I am cheer, I have to be cheerful, I have to think about other point of view, I need to follow non-reaction and goodwill and stuff. So whenever I tend to at least think that I should do something, I feel that I am separated, and I think that I am a devotee, so I have all these qualities. So does this mean that I am an if I follow this and I bring some result, does it mean that I am an individual and I realize that I am able to understand that mind is a part of supermind? Or I think I am not putting up the question correctly, but I have a little confusion in like how an individual, as an individuality, is it the mind which perceives the individuality, or how it works?
I think there is a confusion, and I'm not sure that I'll be able to sort it out in a few minutes. The analogy following the script is, we're following a process of involution where the divine becomes the universe. We are at the point where we have forgotten the script. We don't know there's a script. We don't know we're acting. We don't know we're supposed to be living a part. We're trying to figure everything out for ourselves. If we want to recover our true individuality, we can't do it with the ignorant mind. Obviously, we can't do it by, like Lydia, by running after everything that we like and doing what we want. We can't do it the way Lizzie has been doing it, by having her own opinion, ignorant opinions of everything. We can't do it by just following our own inspirations. We have to do it by rejecting the ignorance that we're living in, quiet the mind, quiet the will, go in, consecrate to Mother and ask Mother. Mother is the director. Mother knows the script. Our true individuality is not following our individual inspiration. Our true individuality comes from withdrawing from the ignorance of the surface. Lydia is following the ignorance of the surface. Elizabeth does it. All the characters do it. Mrs. Bennett does it. We get out of that because we don't know the script. So how do we know the script? We have to start listening instead of talking. We have to be quiet instead of taking initiative. If you offer everything, if we offer everything to Mother, if we act out of higher values of goodwill, self-giving, taking the other person's point of view, all of the methods I listed there will help us to get in tune with the script, get in tune with the divine intention for our lives. The script is Mother's intention for our lives. I'll just summarize here, and then we'll go on, because I want to hear Chandra's presentation. The key is we have to get out of our mind and ego and ignorance of functioning, and get back to know what the real script is for us. The best method for that is remembering Mother and consecrating everything we do. All the methods I listed will help us rediscover the script, rediscover the part that we're supposed to play in life, rather than running around doing what Lydia does and all the other characters do. It's a very good question. You can try to frame it. Take your time, and we'll try to answer it in more detail. As soon as everyone else is...
Thank you, sir, for the explanation. I was asking, like, is it us who frame... I mean, you gave the explanation for that. Maybe I'll frame my question in a better way to make it more understandable.
Good. Very good. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.